From the Sky News Centre at 6. The military is helping the emergency services rescue people stranded in Lincolnshire after a river burst its banks because of heavy rain. A state of emergency has been declared in Wainfleet after around 100 homes flooded. A Chinese-owned company is making circuit boards for the new top-secret F-35 warplanes flown by Britain and the US. Exception PCB in Gloucestershire produces the parts that control many of the jet's core capabilities. That's according to publicity material from the Ministry of Defence. Our Foreign Affairs editor Deborah Haynes says there have been suspicions of China trying to get information on these aircraft.
So the idea that there is a Chinese-owned company, and we're not saying that it's done anything wrong at all, it's just the idea that there is a Chinese-owned company that is part of that supply chain, that's causing real surprise.
The MOD says the firm presents no risk. Public Health England says two more patients have died in hospital after eating sandwiches and salads linked to a listeria outbreak. It brings the total number of deaths to 5. A wreath-laying vigil and silent walk are taking place in West London this evening to mark 2 years since the Grenfell Tower tragedy. 72 people died when the high-rise caught fire. Matt Rack from the Fire Brigades Union is worried the disaster could be repeated as not enough has changed.
Nothing substantial has happened. We have buildings still with flammable cladding. Fire doors that don't work, windows that aren't fitted properly, Grenfell, the smoke extractor system that didn't work, the lack of fire alarms, measures which firefighters would expect to be in place if they attend a fire.
Boris Johnson seemingly bowed to pressure from other Conservative leadership candidates and agreed to appear in a TV debate. He'll take part in one on Tuesday. And in sport, England have thrashed the West Indies by 8 wickets at the Cricket World Cup. The favourites to lift the trophy have now won 3 of their first 4 group matches. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
BCFM 93.2.
BCFM. This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock, and welcome to the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Ashley Ward, Mike Davies, and joining us on the line is one of our newly elected South West MEPs for the Brexit Party, James Clancy. Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, well, how much more horrific for everyone, except the oil and the arms industry, of course, would an illegal war with Iran be than that with Iraq? We zoom in on the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, why we need to know exactly what's going on with the oil tankers there. Also, clashes in Hong Kong, extradition to China is the issue. Could this have anything to do with the imprisonment of Huawei chief financial officer and the threat to extradite her to the United States from Canada, or for that matter, Julian Assange from the UK? And 20 years since the Kosovo War and Declaration of Independence, one of the catalysts for the breakup of Tito's Yugoslavia, a model East meets West former state, which is now dominated by NATO and Western interests. A presidential candidate in Montenegro, for example, was arrested for alleged fraud on election day and has recently undergone a show trial because it looked like he might get elected. We hear from the UK Defence Secretary at the time, who went on to become NATO Secretary General, and of course, Bilderberger George Robertson. And Libya, the remnants of one of the two great examples of social justice that worked in the world, along with Yugoslavia, destroyed the country, and Colonel Gaddafi has been framed and executed by the mob. We revisit 2011. Also, Trump's amazing amnesia when it comes to WikiLeaks. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at Tuesday at noon. This week, a tribute to Martin Cosgrave, co-founder of Dialect, who died last week in Malaga, Spain. A Dialect interview by Martin from 2006. Some satirical songs by his much-loved Dialect satirist, Stanley Forbes, and much more. That's on dialectradio.co.uk right now, and next week on Tuesday, midday. But I'm joined, I hope, on the line right now by James Clancy. Hi, James, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, thank you for having me on today.
James, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What's your background? Now you're representing us as an MEP.
Yeah, of course. My background's a military one, so all my adult life I was in the Royal Marines and until up to 5 years ago. So I was based initially down in Exeter, in the Commando Training Centre, and then went up to 40 Commando in Taunton. And for that just over 10 year period, I did three tours of Afghanistan. I served in Sierra Leone, in fact, all around the world, and then also during the Arab Spring. So since I left university, my life is kind of dominated by international politics. And since I left the military, I started a business, which still runs, called Another Day. But I actually stood down from that because I wanted to pursue one of my passions, which is wildlife and conservation. And I'm a director of the charity Veterans for Wildlife, and we work around the world, but predominantly in Africa, training rangers to combat poaching and illegal wildlife trade. And lately I've been doing some TV shows on Discovery Channel about wildlife on Discovery Channel Shark Week. But a lot of my time now is really sort of focused on combating the illegal wildlife trade across the world.
Okay, not a lot of mention there about Brexit, but you're an MEP now for the Brexit Party. What drew you to stand?
I think probably just frustration, as many people are on all sides of the debate, that we had an election, there was a referendum in 2016, and Leave won, and we left it to Parliament to enact that. And we then had a general election, and both parties pledged to enact on the results of the referendum, and they didn't do that. And I think the huge frustration, having served my country, and I strongly believe in democracy and in parliamentary sovereignty, and to see that being diminished, like many people, I was just sat listening to news, watching television, and increasingly frustrated. So on the 29th of March, when we didn't leave, I met some people who founded the Brexit Party, Richard Tice, the chairman, and he said, "We're looking for candidates. Would you be interested?" And I didn't have long to make a decision, so I said, "Yeah, I will make a stand on this issue." And I actually thought the meaningful vote that Theresa May was going through Parliament in MP3, I actually thought that might get through. I didn't think the election would happen. But it did, and we fought a campaign for 6 weeks, and amazingly, a new party, the Brexit Party, with a really great array of slate of candidates, we won. We've got 29 MEPs, including myself, and we start on the 2nd of July in Strasbourg, and that's when Parliament, this session, sits.
Now, one of the criticisms of the Brexit Party is, James, it's nothing to do with anything else apart from Brexit. And do you have a wider interest in politics and views on other political issues other than getting us out of the European Union?
Yeah, I understand people talk about that criticism and talk manifestos. Interestingly, having been to Brussels on Monday, who did our induction, I just didn't realise that actually as an MEP, as part of Parliament, you can't actually change much. You can't enact your own legislation. It all comes from the Commission. I thought we'd actually have more power to sort of do stuff, block stuff, change stuff. I didn't realise how ineffectual we are. But yes, the Brexit Party has been founded on the premise of ensuring or trying to force Parliament to enact the referendum result. But, as you know, there could well be a general election in the next 12 months. And so it has been decided, the party has decided it is definitely going to run in a general election. And so now we are looking at a full slate of policies, and there's policy development going on as we speak. And from a personal point of view, yeah, I studied history. I studied politics at school, history and politics at school. And I am interested in politics because it affects all of our lives in every way, whether you're interested in the environment, whether you're interested in international relations, the health service. It's important to be engaged. So I have always kept up to speed on these issues. I just didn't imagine that come to July or to June 2019 that I would be, at the coalface of politics in the European Parliament.
Well, you certainly are, although, of course, you know, that still stands, that criticism of, you know, you being effectively a protest party for the time being. Does it worry you that you're open to be compared to Jeremy Corbyn? A lot of the right often say, well, he's a protest prime minister. Well, you're the same, aren't you? You're not really serious about politics.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean serious about politics. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn certainly is. He's been around for a long time, and he's campaigned, and he's been one of the few politicians that has maintained a sort of very steady course on his beliefs. And I'm not here to defend him or Labour, but Labour is the second oldest party in the British political system, so it's not just a protest vote. And of course, they won three elections under Tony Blair. But from our point of view, on the elections in May for the European elections, yes, we were protests. We campaigned on changing politics for good. We campaigned on a platform of sending a message to Westminster that they have to respect democracy. But as I've just said to you, we are now in a policy development stage, preparing for the general election, whenever that comes.
Okay, well, focusing on Brexit, we've had some more news this week. The MPs failed to get a no-deal Brexit vote through. Oliver Letwin, the Conservative big brain behind the bid to block a no-deal Brexit, sounded like a lottery winner who had lost his golden ticket after defeat on Wednesday this week. We'll talk to you in a minute about this, James, but let's start with you, Martin Summers. Can MPs still stop a no-deal Brexit after their defeat this week? Oliver Letwin, who's one of the Tory rebels, seems to think maybe they can't anymore.
Well, it's if I was teaching A-level politics, I would say, well, it's fascinating to ask that question, isn't it, Tony? What is the constitutional position when you get to this position? The stuff I've been reading suggests that there are potential ways to block it. And there are other ways in which, you know...
Are you not saying what they are?
Well, I don't know what they are.
What about the potential? There's one potential, isn't there, that Theresa May could just carry on as Prime Minister?
Oh, yes, Theresa May is still Prime Minister, and she's made it clear that unless, for example, it looks like Boris Johnson's going to be selected as Tory leader, that unless he can win a vote of confidence in the House of Commons, then she won't stand down for him. And that's the constitutional position. This whole Brexit debate, including the fuss about what's happening in the Good Friday Agreement in Ireland and the possibilities of Britain breaking up like Yugoslavia in the 1990s, is a fascinating lesson in civics. And, you know, okay. Everybody is going to have to look at their rule books, aren't they?
Yugoslavia's later, but what about this whole... I mean, if there's a vote in the House of Commons at the moment, there are quite a few people who have said, Conservatives and former Conservatives, who said they vote against... They vote in a no-confidence vote against the Prime Minister.
Yeah, well, when I looked at what the votes stacked up at this week, the government won by 11 votes, but that's because several Labour MPs voted with the government because they're pro-Brexit. Meanwhile, of course, quite a lot of Tories voted against the government because they're against Brexit. And we're talking about no-deal Brexit and Brexit. There's a bit of a difference. I mean, Nigel Farage in the referendum campaign said anybody who said that we had to leave the single market if we left the EU was scaremongering. So I don't think there is a mandate for a no-deal Brexit, and we shall see as we go forward. And it's going to be very interesting.
So, Boris Johnson always going to be the front runner, I'm afraid, Mike. It's almost like one of those, what do you make of the Conservative leadership challenge at the moment and in relation to Brexit? Mike Davis, you're a local Labour MP here. Sorry! Councillor, not quite an MP yet, anyway.
Wow, I think it's a pretty unedifying spectacle to see some of these candidates saying they actually want a no-deal Brexit, which would be crushing to the economy. Some of the candidates...
Well, hang on, because back in the time when we were about to join the Euro, we were told, oh, if you don't join the Euro, it's going to be a crushing economic defeat. Actually, it wasn't. And in fact, what's happened is that some of the countries that joined the Euro have had a terrible time, like Greece, for example.
Well,
why do you think it's definitely bad economically? That's what I'm trying to get from you.
Because so many of our trade agreements, trade deals, the way our economy works with all these other countries that we're involved with is tied up with all these EU laws and regulations. And so if you just drive off a cliff, then you know, we're going to run out of food, we're going to run out of medicine. You know, there's been economic studies to show that it would have a crushing effect on the economy, particularly for the poorest areas in the country. You know, most
many of whom, by the way, voted for Brexit, didn't
okay,
they?
Okay, yeah, but most countries in the world are part of a trading bloc with the countries that are nearby to them, because it just makes sense, you know, and that's what we were in. I'd hope that in the future we can have a deal that protects all this infrastructure
so
we've got.
You're painting a picture of a pretty grim winter with possibly people starving?
There's a possibility of it. And I'd be interested to know from the Brexit Party. I mean, I understand that they don't have policies on everything because they're a single-issue party, but I'm not quite clear what their policy on Brexit is either. Do they want no deal? Is that what they're saying?
Okay, well, maybe you can answer both of those two, James, if you don't mind. So one is about the economic disaster that's going to hit us on Halloween. Such a perfect day to be... jumping off a cliff, as we've just heard from Mike there. But also, what is your policy? Maybe you can just look at those two on Brexit. Do you want a no deal?
So, well, I'll just take that first point, this invented idea of a cliff edge. Ollie Robbins, chief negotiator, today has come out and said that we are almost certainly going to be ready for a no deal on the 31st of October. The civil service has been working incredibly hard to prepare the country. Now, that is, you know, everybody knows that that is not the preferred outcome. We want a free trade deal, and the Brexit Party's policy is to negotiate a free trade deal. And the way we see it on the 31st of October is to leave at this moment without a deal, and then to go onto the global agreement for trade, the GATT terms of zero tariffs between the EU and the European Union. What that means is that we know that things like the flow of medicines, all that stuff on food, that will continue uninterrupted. That and also ensure that there are not tariffs that discriminate against our industries, our exports, or our imports. That's the position that we want to implement for 2 years whilst we negotiate a free trade deal. And he's absolutely right to mention that other countries in the world are part of trading blocs. For example, America, Canada, Mexico are in NAFTA. And we will want to we want to negotiate trade deals with as many countries as possible. But what you don't need is a political union. You don't need to have a political union to have good quality trading relationships with other countries. And Canada, New Zealand are great examples of successful countries that flourish without being in a political union like the European Union.
What about your party's policy? Do you want a no deal?
Say again?
Do you want a no deal?
Well, we want to leave the European Union, and we want to leave on the 31st of October. And that will mean, as I said before, leaving without this deal, without Theresa May's new treaty, and going on to GATT conditions for 2 years whilst we negotiate a free trade deal. So our policy is we want to negotiate a free trade deal. We don't want to remain on the WTO terms forever. We want to negotiate a free trade deal.
But that could take a very long time, couldn't it? I mean, especially since we've heard from Jean-Claude Juncker that he's not going to make things easy for Britain if they do leave on a no deal.
Well, look, you've got to remember at the moment, all our standards and regulations are equivalent. We're in complete harmony. So it's not like approaching this from Canada's point of view, where they have a completely different set of regulations and standards. And it took 6 years to negotiate with the European Union for their trade deal. We don't need to spend that long because we've already got the equivalence. So it shouldn't take that long. I think actually the biggest thing what's been holding Britain up, it is really paralysis in Parliament. The fact that when Theresa May held that general election, she didn't get a majority, which has meant she's been beholden to the DUP, and Parliament's been massively split between Remain and Leave groups, which transcends party politics. And we've got ourselves into this position where we're all stuck. Everybody is fed up with the term Brexit, and we just want to get on with it.
Okay, looking at some of the other Brexit-related stories this week, I suppose it's Brexit-related anyway, is Boris Johnson is refusing to say if he's taking cocaine despite previous admissions. Now, this is a fascinating bit of proper journalism in The Independent, where they have gone and said, well, actually, he said in the past he did take cocaine, but now he's avoiding the subject like crazy. Mike Davis from the Labour Party here in Bristol, what are your thoughts about this? Because what's your thoughts on cocaine and legalisation of that sort of thing, and also on Boris, but mainly on the drug issue generally?
I think the drug laws we've got have totally failed. I think that we should have a completely new legal framework for drugs. I think that would cut crime, I think that would save money, and I think that would reduce harm for some of the people who are dependent on drugs.
I mean, if you're talking about decriminalising it, does that mean young people would have access to drugs? Over the counter?
There are different kinds of drugs, and, you know, people who advocate for drug law reform aren't saying that you could walk into Tesco and buy heroin or crack, you know. You know, we are saying that, you know, some of the less harmful drugs, you know, should be available to people to buy with clear warnings on them that, you know, notify people what is in them and the harms that those drugs can do, because all drugs can do harms.
But I mean, cigarettes and alcohol also.
Exactly, and alcohol is one of the worst drugs, and that's readily available in any corner shop and supermarket.
Martin, what about Michael Gove's admission about taking cocaine and Boris's refusal to say anything, even though he's on the record as having taken it?
Well, I mean, this is internal infighting within the Tory party. Don't forget, at the end of the day, it's the Tory party membership who are going to decide who the Prime Minister is. And they tend to be over 60 and rather conservative in their views about these matters. So whatever these guys have done or not done, they've got to either get it out of the way or say that they haven't done it or whatever. But of course, I mean, I agree with Mike. I mean, the drug laws are a joke, farcical. And, of course, underlying all of this is the when the banking system collapsed in 2008, there was a UN Office on Drugs and Crime did a report in 2009. It's mostly police officers who wrote the report. And they said what happened there is the drug cartels just went to the banks and said, you need some money. Guess what? We've got some. And that was both government intervention and the drug cartels. And, of course, they're actually linked because of the CIA's links with drugs going back to the 1940s. They bailed out the banking system. So while we're sending teenagers to Borstal for dealing drugs, meanwhile the banks are being propped up by these people. And, of course, in certain social circles, snorting cocaine at parties was perfectly normal, especially at the top.
I mean, I must admit,
in the City of London, for example,
we've seen accusations about George Osborne and people who were in the Bullingdon Club, taking cocaine freely, and I was quite surprised that Boris didn't just simply admit it. But anyway, James, what's your view on this whole issue? Because it's very much tied in at the moment, anyway, the use of illegal drugs with organised crime.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've got consensus with what the other two guests have just said, because we've just had a report out by the Royal Society for Public Health, and they've urged the government to decriminalise personal possession of all illegal drugs. And as radical as that sounds, they've done that in Portugal, and it has reduced addiction, it has reduced death rates. It's proved to be positive. And by the way, what I'm saying here is from a personal point of view, not a point of view of the party. But, I think there is a strong case for the legalisation of cannabis, and especially for medical use. I think that our argument's been pretty clear in America. And I totally agree that our current laws are failing, and they are fueling a bitter underworld, which is causing a big part of this this national crisis of knife crime. And from my military experience, having served in Afghanistan and seen the massive poppy fields that create opiates, which of course also create heroin, you realise that the illegal trade in narcotics is fueling one of the largest illicit criminal networks in the world. And
governments across, whether it's the US, Britain, we have all failed to fight this industry. We failed in that war, so we need to look at other ways to address the issues of drugs. And clearly, that what we have at the moment is failing. So I would personally support taking on the recommendations of the Royal Society of Public Health and seriously look at decriminalising possession.
Well, we've just had these European Union MEP elections, but now it's time to decide who's going to be really run the European Union, which is the European Commission. And I noticed this week, James, Angela Merkel has joined Macron in calling for an EU army to complement NATO. Also, that Macron would support Merkel to be the president of the European Commission. The German Chancellor is not officially a candidate, but Macron is saying that she's the sort of person that could do the job. Apparently, there's been a bit of infighting over who's going to be appointed to this task. Is there anything you know, for example, on Monday in your induction, is how they decide who's going to be commissioner? Because it's not an election that the public have anything to do with, is it?
No. I am fairly new to this. I'm learning, and that was news to me. Very interesting that she's interested in it, Angela Merkel.
I'm not sure she is. It's just that she's being recommended by Macron, the French president. He's saying, oh, she'd make a good job of it, because she's kind of on her way out in politics. And, of course, this is one of the things that we notice in the European Commission, is almost all of them are failed politicians, people who've kind of done their time, been de-elected by parties or by the people.
Yeah, I mean, that is extraordinary. I think we know the arguments that there is a huge deficit of a democratic deficit across the European Union. I'm surprised, having just been out there, and I look forward to going and sort of learning more in July, I'm surprised the response to Brexit has not been to try and improve accountability and to try and increase the transparency and democratic processes in the EU, because that would really quell a lot of people's arguments about, you know, democracy, which we have been campaigning on. But there just seems to be absolutely no intention to reduce the size of the EU or to reform it, which I find, you know, staggering, given that the rise of Eurosceptic parties across the European Union. But you did touch on an important point, which is we were told that there was no aspiration to create an EU defence force, an EU army to rival NATO. And it is now fully in motion. And I don't agree that it's there to support NATO, because NATO has proven to itself to be one of the most effective alliances in history, formed in 1949. Why would we want to rival or undermine it or duplicate that when we know it's successful? It helped defeat the Soviet Union in the Cold War by putting so much pressure on them during an arms race. We know it is effective. And why would we want to create a new structure when most of the countries in the European Union don't even spend 2% of their GDP on defence? So that's a real concern of mine. I'm actually going to join. I going to join the European Union Parliament, the European Parliament Defence Committee, to sort of get a better briefing on the issues and what is actually happening.
Well, one of the things that is happening on the 14th of May, although this wasn't really covered very much in the news, apart from on the European Union website, is that 22 EU members have signed the latest thing in the European Defence Union, which is a new programme to facilitate cross-border and air-to-surface permissions in support of military mobility. So this is going to make it much easier, say, for example, for French military units to travel around and do exercises and things in Germany. And anyone, basically militaries from various individual member states of the EU, to act in the same as other ones. But it was I checked very carefully here, and I noticed that the UK did not sign up to this. So even though we're still in the EU officially, we're not necessarily going along with these defence union pledges. I mean, Martin Summers, are you concerned about the idea of a European defence union? Because it definitely seems like it's happening. It's just that Britain is now, since the Brexit referendum, is being left behind in this union.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, the European Union is a cat's paw for US power. It always has been. And this is essentially symbolic and it's got no real legs to it. I mean, I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia during the 1990s, and there was no way that the EU could intervene in there militarily, and nor ultimately could NATO, because when people want to fight each other, it's very hard to stop them. NATO, of course, is actually not necessarily such a good organisation. James, we talk about NATO quite a lot in this show, and it's not always complimentary. I don't suppose you know about the Gladio networks that were set up in the 1940s to so-called stay-behind networks, which police investigation in Italy and Belgium and Switzerland have shown to be terrorists, basically. They bombed Bologna railway station, they assassinated Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister of Italy, all of which was a part of trying to keep the Communist Party out of power in Italy. This is the underside of NATO. NATO doesn't just go around helping people, it's actually a military organisation. And of course, it's got a very dark, dark deep state side to it.
It's a military organisation.
Yeah, but it's got a very dark deep state side to it, is what I'm telling you. Imposimato was the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who died recently. He wrote a book in 2012 called La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, because he was the investigating magistrate on all of this stuff, what they call the Anni di Piombo in Italy. And basically, all the terrorism in Italy, left and right wing, in the 70s and 80s, was being orchestrated from SHAPE in Brussels. And of course, that's the real world. The Russian General Staff know all this. I wonder if ex-Royal Marines know what we're talking about.
Certainly some of our listeners do, but let's let Mike have his say on. I mean, one of the things with this European Defence Union is it starts to look more and more like a kind of United States of Europe, and that I think is one of the reasons, you know, for the sovereignty reasons, never mind immigration, that many people voted for Brexit. Might
I mean, I don't think I have enough knowledge of this to have a well-informed opinion, but what I will say is for most of Europe's history they've had terrible, terrible wars, and I mean even in the 20th century in Europe, you know, terrible, terrible wars, millions of people dying. Personally, I don't see European integration as a huge problem.
Well, what about that? The role of the European Union, James, in actually keeping the peace since the end of the Second World War in Europe?
Well, it hasn't, has it? Because it's it was only founded in 1991, the European Union, under the Treaty of Maastricht. I mean, there's a lie going around saying, oh, it's kept peace. Well, no, it hasn't. You know, the European coal and steel union was created in the 1950s, and then it was a single market. It wasn't a political union. It was a single market. What has kept peace in Europe is NATO. And also, and a variety of things. You know, think about the amount of money America pumped in to European countries to rebuild them and bring prosperity to Europe. And that those factors, the fact that security has been underwritten by America and Britain to a large extent, that's what's created peace and prosperity in Europe. And the European Union, as we now know, is only a relatively recent phenomenon. And what we do know is, as you previously stated, that the single currency has actually brought a lot of poverty to southern Europe. And we are now experiencing, worryingly, the rise of some very extreme organizations, political parties in France, in Germany, across Eastern Europe, because people feel disenfranchised. They feel that they've been left behind. And there are a whole range of issues that aren't being addressed by European Union. And closer integration, by taking power away from people, less accountability, less democracy, is only going to build up further resentment and allow those parties to gain strength. So, no, I don't credit the European Union with peace and prosperity. There's many other factors.
Before we get off of Brexit, final point for discussion here is a question at Prime Minister's Questions this week on Wednesday, which was brought up about the possibility that Parliament might be prorogued. In other words, that the Queen and the Prime Minister might shut down Parliament in order to get Brexit through.
We're streeting!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the event that a Prime Minister ask Her Majesty the Queen to prorogue Parliament against the express wishes of a majority of the House of Commons, whose advice would the Queen be obliged to follow? the advice of her Prime Minister or the express will of this House?
Knows, I will not stand at this dispatch box and speak about decisions that Her Majesty the Queen might make. What I would say is that we see a situation tonight in a motion, this afternoon in a motion, where the Labour Party and the SNP are trying to take control away from the government of the business of this House. Governments are able to govern. Governments are able to govern by having control of the business of this House, and that's what everybody should recall.
Well, she was kind of hedging her bets there and equivocating. But it's, a potential crisis in itself, James, isn't it? You're one of our MEPs now for the Brexit Party. I mean, could the attempt to railroad a no-deal through and upsetting all those MPs actually cause an even bigger crisis?
Well, that would be a constitutional crisis of the highest order. To put the decision onto the Queen, I think it would be highly damaging to the monarchy. And as a military person and a monarchist, I would not want to see that happen. I wouldn't want to see the Queen put in the spotlight in that way. It's the wrong thing to do. The Parliament, the MPs, they have a responsibility to deliver on their manifestos for 2018, which they elected on, which was to respect the result of the referendum. And they need to deliver Brexit themselves. They need to find consensus to take us out of the European Union. Now, we're doing our best by putting pressure on them through the Brexit Party, but I honestly think it would be a disaster for this country to go down the route of putting that pressure on our Queen and creating a constitutional crisis.
Martin Summers, do you think it could all come down to what the Queen thinks?
Well, I mean, what she would say is that she took the advice of her Prime Minister of the day, if that's the route she chose to go down. But as James said, it would be a constitutional crisis of enormous proportions. Like, this whole thing is a constitutional crisis. Don't forget that if you look at the results of the EU elections, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland all voted solidly for Remain parties. So you're talking about ultimately potentially international borders on the Severn Bridge. And people need to think about this, because this is what happened in Yugoslavia in 1991. When Slovenia declared independence, everybody thought, well, they let them have a bit of independence.
Martin, Wales is going to leave the EU too, isn't it?
But it depends, doesn't it? Because the whole thing is about the Irish backstop, which is England or the rest of the rump UK.
If we leave without a deal,
there will be, because when you go back to the EU to discuss the deal that James is saying he wants with them, the first thing they're going to say is no backstop in Ireland. Of course, and Sinn Féin and the Irish government made it very clear that there will have to be a referendum on a united Ireland as a follow-through to a no-deal Brexit. That's already on the table. And, of course, the Scots are also saying they will go for independence. And then the Welsh will have to decide what they want to do, but they're looking at the opinion polls in Wales and the results of the election. There isn't a majority there either.
Labour councillor Mike Davies, what do you make of the Queen having to make this decision when it comes to October?
Well, firstly, I'd say the Tories have totally lost the plot for any of them to be suggesting something like this. I mean, we're a parliamentary democracy to... You know, but what I'd also say is, I am not a monarchist. I believe we should have an elected head of state, so that the elected head of state would have a democratic mandate to make the right decision in that sort of situation.
Well, that's an interesting point, Mike. I'll put that to you, James, because you've said, "Oh, yes, I'm a monarchist," but and yet, when it comes to the European Union, you're against the idea of having appointees running at the Commission level.
Well, I mean, it's a bit of an ironic position that he's just taken there to say he wants an elected head of state, but we don't have any elected commission, we don't have an elected president of the European Union. In fact, there's a huge, huge deficit of democracy in the European Union. The Queen's role is a figurehead. She's amazing value for money compared to having a president, which is enormously expensive. Now, if you want a Donald Trump figurehead instead of the Queen, then you're welcome to that view. But we do, he's correct to say, we live in a parliamentary democracy, and it's absolutely up to Parliament to resolve this issue. And they've been elected on a mandate, both of them, both parties, with manifestos which were clear, deliver the results of the referendum.
Okay, on to some local stuff now. And Hargreaves Chiefs are in a £6 million share sale. High Flyers cashed in weeks before Woodford crisis sent stocks tumbling. This is a crisis going on locally, Mike Davis, at Hargreaves Lansdowne, where it looks as if some of the directors of the company, I mean, I really should keep saying the word allegedly, probably every other word now, knew what was happening with those share prices, and they sold all their shares a few days later, as the actual share price plummeted. So this is one of our supposedly big trusted big institutions here, of the business community, here in the southwest, Hargreaves Lansdowne, where it looks as if there could even potentially be charges of insider dealing against some of these directors, where people have trusted many of their pensions and their savings to Hargreaves Lansdowne to do these investments.
This is the first I've heard of this, and maybe it's better for someone
else Martin, to comment. Okay, yes, it's been in the local press, and it's been in, actually, This Is Money, which is the national. I mean, yeah, this is a supposed big trusted institution. Stephen Lansdowne, is it Peter Hargreaves, I think, Martin?
Yeah, well, as you know, we've had Rowan Bosworth Davis on here, the former head of the Metropolitan Police Fraud Squad, and he told us on this show that he'd interviewed Peter Hargreaves several times under caution. And, of course, it's not just Hargreaves Lansdowne. The whole financial services sector is corrupt to the core. And, of course, what should have happened, as Peter Galbraith, the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, who's a professor in Austin, Texas, has pointed out, you need to arrest loads of people and send them to prison. Because if you just fine the institutions, that's not enough of a deterrent to what they've been doing. And don't forget, we've had austerity for the last decade, because we bailed these banks out. If you're going to follow a free market textbook, we should have let them go down and send them all to prison. We didn't do that. Meanwhile, people are dying and of lack of care, and we've got everybody in food banks.
So the story runs like this. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Two high flyers at Hargreaves Lansdowne sold millions of pounds of shares in the company just weeks before its ties with a troubled fund manager, Neil Woodford, caused the stock to tumble. The financial services group's research director, Mark Dampier, his wife, Annette, and the firm's chief investment officer, Lee Gardhouse, sold shares worth £6.1 million last month. The move will enrage investors in Woodford's $3.7 billion equity income fund, who were frozen out of their nest eggs this week after years of dismal performance. James, this is, I suppose, a question of financial potential, anyway, an alleged financial crime here, with directors of a business using their inside knowledge to sell all their shares whilst not telling those that have invested in Hargreaves Lansdowne's this particular share fund. I think you may want to also answer the wider question about how safe and how trustworthy are our financial services in this country?
I can't comment accurately on that individual case, but what we do know that before 2008, there was a huge amount of insider trading. There was clearly fixing on LIBOR. There was just a lack of oversight, regulation, and clearly a lack of morals within the financial sector, which led to the crash. Since then, we've almost gone the other way. We've got a huge amount of regulation across the City of London, and that, you know, that in many ways is damaging, and I'm not sure we've definitely got the right balance. But what is a shame in this situation? It's a question of ethics, isn't it? I mean, people knowingly and fraudulently committing white collar crime. To me, it's absolutely no different from robbing a bank or robbing people of their savings. It's a question of ethics, and I do hope that the full force of the law comes down on them, on these directors.
Okay, that's if they are shown to have committed any crime. We just have to couch that in. This is all very speculative, but it's a fast. I'll put a link, as I say, up to this article. It's in This Is Money. The headline is Hargreaves Lansdowne's Chiefs in £6 million share sale. High Flyers cashed in weeks before the Woodford crisis sent stocks tumbling, Martin. It's also part of a pattern, isn't it, in the whole financial sector. We've got the Financial Conduct Authority that's supposed to regulate financial services in this country actually now being funded through by financial companies themselves.
Yeah, I think the idea that they're over-regulated now is for the birds. I mean, basically, they've been allowed to get away with murder. And what should have happened is, if you're going to bail the banks out, you then go in there and remove the managers completely. The existing managers have to be removed, from their jobs, and of course if they've been any malfeasance, they go to prison, not just fines, prison, and you confiscate their assets. And if you do all of that, you might have quite a fund to keep the fiscal balances straighter than they otherwise might be. And of course you ultimately have to go towards a publicly run banking system. That's where we'll have to end up after the next crash, which of course is coming. While we've been talking about Brexit, the financial sector all over the world has been blowing the biggest bubble in history, which both left-wing and right-wing economists, there's no dispute about this.
I mean,
we all know what's going to happen.
The big question here, Martin, is could Brexit actually burst that bubble?
Well,
the financial centre of the world is supposed to be London still. Maybe that won't be the case.
Well,
let's
put it this way. What may happen as we get closer to a no-deal Brexit is that the George Soros's and other hedge fund managers out there are going to take a bet against the pound because it's money for old rope. And, of course, if they do that, then the pound starts to crash as we go towards no-deal Brexit. And at that point, the government has to raise interest rates and crashes the property market. And we've already seen pretty clearly a slowdown in the US, the slowdown in the British economy as a result of the uncertainty around Brexit. But crashing out won't necessarily solve that. And I don't agree with the idea that there's going to be shortages of medicine. So I think that's scaremongering. The real problems are the possibility of a speculative attack on the currency. And in the medium term, of course, the other side, you may not impose tariffs on the European Union, but they're going to impose tariffs on you. They're not going to let Britain be used as an export machine to break the EU's regulatory framework, and they're prepared to make any sacrifice to prevent that. That's what the French call social dumping.
But, well, can you answer the question though, which is about, you know, we know we're on this financial cliff edge.
Yeah.
I think it's 100 and something trillion. I can't remember the exact figure, but it was the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King that said basically 2008 is going to happen again.
Well, it
because
is.
Nothing has been done to stop it. But next time it will be a full-on crash because governments simply do not have the resources to bail out the banks a second time.
That's right, because basically it's been a big heist by the wealthy classes.
I mean, 2008.
Yeah, and of course, in the real problem at the minute, the most likely place for this to break is in Italy, because Salvini, who did well in the European elections, they're bringing forward an alternative currency or a parallel currency. And, of course, at some point, the EU are then going to respond to that.
The European Union don't like that, do
Well, they? No, they don't like that, no. And there's a question about the euro, which was a bigger question. But, of course, what's likely to happen, Monte dei Paschi is the oldest bank in the world in Siena. It's been on life support for ages. Deutsche Bank is linked to that. Barclays is linked to that. It's all linked to everything else. So it's quite likely that a crash in the Italian banking system will pull everybody down. And in or out of the European Union, it'll be communicated to the British economy in an afternoon. It doesn't really make much difference. And we should have been talking about all of this, but instead we've been talking about who's going to run the parish council.
Fine, another story, which I was hoping was going to be some more in the court cases about it, and that is, Mike, the slavery case of the father of the Conservative MP, Jack Lopresti. The ice cream boss exploited his staff, a boss of a popular ice cream firm based in Bristol, accused of slavery offences, had a history of making workers endure poor conditions. Salvatore Sam Lopresti, 75, of Lopresti Ice Cream in Bristol, has made the subject of a slavery and trafficking risk order. He was ruled unfit to stand trial on assault and modern slavery charges because he has dementia. However, an investigation heard claims of terribly exploitative treatment of staff. The Bristol Cable was first to raise these concerns in 2016 when an undercover journalist was employed there for well below the minimum wage. Other former employees said they worked long hours, low pay, poor conditions in properties owned by Mr. Lopresti. He had amassed a significant amount of money, power and status within the city and exploited that in a way with impunity for years and years, said Adam Cantwell Corn of the Cable. Mike, what do you make of this? This is the father of one of our MPs being now the subject of a slavery and trafficking risk order.
Well, I agree it hasn't been in the news much, and, you know,
surprising, isn't it, really?
I think the Bristol Cable does a lot of good work in raising a lot of stories that other media outlets wouldn't raise. I think modern slavery is a huge issue our country.
Just looking at the wages here, one former employee who Mr. Lopresti described him as a volunteer worker, apparently, said he was paid between £10 and £30 a week.
Well, yeah, as I said, I think modern slavery is a huge issue in our country, in our economy. We see that with things like this, with these hand car washes we see where, you know, there's a lot of questions about those, and I think that should be a much bigger story, how prevalent this is. Nail bars as well. Yeah.
James, what do you make of this whole thing now in the UK, where it seems that joblessness is causing people to be really desperate? I mean, maybe this is also part of the rise in people joining drug dealers, dealing illegal drugs, simply because they're finding it so difficult to get work. And even low-paid work sometimes simply doesn't pay the bills.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not... Again, that this local story is new to me. It's just disgraceful to think that you have modern slavery in the UK and the Western world, but it does exist. One area I'm more aware of it is on the high seas, where we deal with illegal fishing. A lot of those boats contain slaves. People are on those ships for years at a time that can't get off. It's absolutely tragic. What you've just stated there, I'm not sure totally factually correct in terms of the job market, because Britain is experiencing the highest employment rates in almost 40 years.
But James, our employment rates are very high. It's just that still many of those people who have got even full-time jobs are having to claim benefits, many even having to go to food banks too.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's a good situation. There needs to be reform, but at the same time, I'm just stating the fact that in this country we have much better employment opportunities, jobs, compared to anywhere else on the continent. This situation highlights something that is absolutely disgraceful, but I can only say it's not accurate to say that people can't get jobs or there are not jobs on offer.
Okay, well, next subject should probably be our final one before the 7 o'clock is 5G, because Bristol doesn't have a 5G network. I know it's terrible, I can't get fast enough download speeds on my phone yet, but Glastonbury Town Council has decided they're not going to have 5G. They had a vote on it a couple of weeks ago. We're looking at the 9th of July as the 5G rollout date here in Bristol by Vodafone, but there are a lot of people who are very concerned that actually 5G networks are more powerful than the previous ones, that the radiation is a microwave radiation, and that because there's a much more density of these transmitters all the way down the street, that it could be a health hazard, and nobody seems to be able to actually prove that this is safe. So let's have a listen now to a report that went out on Wednesday on Points West, at least the beginning of it this week.
Hello, good evening. A council is fighting plans to roll out the next generation of phone technology. 5G promises a much faster connection for using the internet on mobiles and better signal coverage.
But Glastonbury Town Council's joined cities like Brussels in saying it doesn't want it until there's more evidence about any impact on health. Here's our health correspondent, Matthew Hill.
5G promises a revolution. Much quicker speeds, allowing us to download huge amounts of data. This 5G smart tourism project allows us to travel back in time to see the Roman baths. And it's already here.
Final preparations are underway here at the Glastonbury Festival. That includes 5G for better communications around the sprawling site.
But some people in the nearby town of Glastonbury are concerned. The town council passed a motion last night to oppose 5G.
There is no hard proof that there is a problem with 5G.
But there's nothing that categorically says it's perfectly safe.
5G uses high-frequency radio waves to carry more data, much higher frequencies than current mobile technology. It'll need thousands of transmitters, almost street by street in big cities. The effects of this technology haven't been tested, although governments and scientists consider the risk very low.
We're fairly confident that it can be regarded as safe.
In Brussels, the government's already banned the rollout of a pilot 5G project as it has more stringent standards on this type of radiation. It wants more research first. The same type of radio waves are used in hospitals in things like MRI scanners, but they have much stricter safety limits. This research group in Switzerland has concerns that the 5G safety limits also need reining in.
ITIS has received some funding from the mobile phone industry, and its claims are disputed. But it says that mobile phones, if used to the full power limits, could cause harm if they're placed next to people's heads.
Well, that's funny, because most people do use their mobile phones right next to their heads. Thanks very much for that report, Matthew Hill, from the local BBC here in Bristol. I think I'll start with you, Mike. Are you desperate for 5G, or are you a bit nervous about it?
I suppose I've never personally had a problem with 4G. My 4G's always worked absolutely fine, so I do kind of wonder what this big rush to have 5G is all about.
Apparently you can now download a feature film within just a few seconds.
That's great, apparently, but I think we should take seriously all the people that are saying that there are concerns about this, and I'd hope that, you know, we're looking at that locally as well.
James, what do you make of this? There is a local petition actually been set up, pause Bristol's 5G rollout, to the Mayor Marvin Rees and Councillor Asher Cray, which has just gone over 4,000. Their aim is 5,000 signatures. They've just gone over 4,000. They want a debate on this, and they want this pause before it rolls out in July. Do you think we're being a bit paranoid, or do you think that this is a necessary technology?
Well, both are correct. Because the 5G network will create a whole lot of opportunities for the economy, and there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, there is definitely a public health risk, because these antennas that you need to rebroadcast these radio waves, you need them every 500 metres, so pretty much in every street. So that's an intense amount of high-frequency waves being thrown about in populated areas. And do we really understand what the effect of essentially having your head in a microwave, or your body exposed to that all the time, what the long-term health implications are?
Well, I think the long-term health implications of that sounds to me as if your head would be cooked.
Well, it doesn't sound good, does it? And, you know, the problem is with having the telecoms industry financing studies is they're only incentivized to roll this stuff out as quickly as possible, because it's going to increase their revenues. So there needs to be independent analysis. It's difficult, because many industries will be going to want this. I'm personally not too bothered. I am concerned also about the Huawei networks and the security implications of that for Britain. And I'm also concerned just about the intrusion on our lives, and that every lamppost, every kettle front door is now in the future set to be put online. That is an incredibly intrusive, invasive technology that's going to be part of our life, and something that we won't be able to escape. And I don't think we fundamentally have the debate publicly about whether we want this.
No, quite right. Also, I would just point out that these are microwaves. The 5G is microwaves, and though in that report by Matthew Hill, he talks about them as radio waves. Anyway, thanks to our guests, Labour Councillor for Ashley, Mike Davis, and joining us on the line, newly elected South West MEP for the Brexit Party, James Glancy. Thanks very much. Join me after the US-owned Comcast News at 7 as we spread our wings around the world.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.